Welcome back to the Pacific Novel Project Workshop Podcast, where Steve Childress,
hello,
and myself, Jason Keith, workshop our manuscripts. I am coming to you live, pre-recorded from Denver, Colorado. And Steve is still in the Great Northwest.
Beaverton, Oregon!
Well, thanks to the wonders of the internet, we're getting together still. Checking out these manuscripts. We're on draft 2. If you want to listen in on Google Play or Patreon or patreon.com/Pacific Novel Project or our website, which is just PacificNovelProject.com. We hope you get something out of it. And if you want to hit up our Patreon, we got some cool stuff there. I'm not going to pimp it all right now. Just check it out. Patreon.com/Pacific Novel Project and see what else we got going on. Anything you want to add to that, Steve?
Nah. Just do it. Do it.
Do it. Do it now.
Do it now.
Do you know where that do it now is from? I do that all the time, and I think I'm the only person who knows where it's from.
Starsky and Hutch.
Starsky and Hutch.
Yeah.
There you go.
Do it. Do it. Do it now.
Awesome. I'm not sure if I like that movie or hate that movie.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. Snoop was totally clutch as Huggy Bear, though. That was great.
Oh, yeah. God, I forgot he was Huggy Bear.
Yeah, he was great, man.
Oh, man, Snoop is funny. You know, he hosts the new wild card game show? It's like...
I know what game show you're talking about.
Yeah, it's like a slot machine game show.
Big money, big money, big money. No whammies, no whammies.
No, that's something else.
Is it? Are you sure?
Oh, Joker's Wild. Yeah, Joker's Wild. It's like a slot machine.
Joker's Wild.
And then depending on what you spin, you can either get out or it affects how much money you get. Oh man, I used to watch that as a kid. He's doing the new version. It's pretty, you know. It's funny because he's in it and they got like goofy categories and stuff.
I'm going to have to check that out, but I'll have to see if I can stream it because I don't have cable. So, you know, anyway.
Well, yeah, I think when I watched it, I watched it on Hulu.
Ah, okay. I'll check out Hulu then. We got Hulu.
I had live Hulu at the time. I don't know if it's on normal Hulu.
Oh, that's a good point.
Do a search for it.
I'll do a search. Yeah, for sure.
Dog. God. His career has evolved interesting, and all the things that scumbaggery things that he's done, we've completely forgotten about.
Hey, that's life in Hollywood or California or LA or you make your choice, make your pick.
I think it's America, one of the few places you can still reinvent yourself.
True. There is a level of that.
All right. Well, if you turn in the first. Tuning in for the first time, we do a lot of sidebars. That was the Snoop Dogg sidebar.
That was the Snoop bar.
All right. So I believe I'm going first this time. And we're doing Hollywood Dreams, historical fiction / noir about Nazis during the 1930s, 1940s in America. The last we left off, Tomb. He had gone to his old friend from the Prohibition days, Richter, a classy art gallery dude. He was helping him look up some information on Nazi watch. And now they are, where did we left off in the middle of a scene?
Oh, in Luz. Yep. And Tomb's got the guest list that Anna gave him.
Yeah. So his daughter, who works for his other friend at his movie studio, who has continued a crooked life, or at least a semi-crooked life, a shady life, got a guest list from a party. They're at Lou's, and they find out that Nancy Kaminsky and Elsa Kaminsky, Nancy's the dead one.
Yes.
Elsa's the living one. We're invited to a party, and they're trying to find out who killed Nancy, and they're trying to hunt down Elsa because she's missing. So they find out that they're at this party at Danny's, and that's where we left off. At Lou's, finding out that the Kaminskys were at the Edgewater Hotel at a party, And that's also the beach outside that hotel is where Nancy's body was found. All right, so Monty was babysitting a brother that showed up, and that's how they got some pictures of this warehouse that Richter owns. And it looked like him and Danny were fighting, or that Danny owns, and was storing some of Richter's stuff, and it looks like they were fighting. Monty is asking Toom if he wants to know about Nancy's brother, the guy who got them the pictures, because he was going to go check on him because they're worried for his safety. Monty says, hey, you going to ask me about Mortimer, Nancy's brother? Toom's a little out of it and says, oh, yeah, what about him? And Monty tells him he's in the hospital. He was getting his ass kicked when I got to the hotel. So I had the question for you. Originally, you had him killed, but now he's alive. I was wondering if you had something else in mind for him or if you just decided not to kill him.
Decided not to kill him for now.
For now.
I kind of want to see what else I might be able to do with him in this draft. And if it goes nowhere, he might just end up just getting killed off earlier, or I might axe them all together. We'll see on the next draft. But I wanted to see if there's might be some place he could fit in, even as just a vehicle.
Okay. Steve is a fickle god.
I am.
Oh, and I forgot to say that was page 121. 122. Let's see. I only made a couple comments on this page. They're just talking about Mortimer being in the hospital. Monty tells them that they got Grady, friendly Flatfoots, uniformed guys to watch over him. I just had a quick question. Lou steps up behind the bar, three glasses pinched between his fingers of both hands. Am I reading that? That's like six glasses?
Yes.
Three for each hand? Okay. And they just made the comment that Lou is a prophet because he said technology is going to replace us all one day because they're talking about how he got a jukebox. So they have a little discussion on what's better, live music or the which is called a Nickelodeon. It's a cool thing about this story. Yeah. Learn a lot of old-fashioned lingo.
Indeed. It's kind of fun.
All right, page 123. Toom is like, hey, let's go to Edgewater tomorrow morning. Chapter 8, a little bit down, 123. Toom's bungalow, May 29th, 1941. I may have said this already. I don't remember if I did, but I just quit paying attention to those dates. I figure once you're ready for another long, long review of the entire manuscript in its entirety, poke at those more.
All right.
So Toom wakes up. Monty's knocking on his door. I didn't comment anything on that half, that bottom half. On 122, they're making coffee, and Monty's filling him in that Grady got some info from Mortimer, but it wasn't much to go on. Toom says, I'm sure if we could find the missing sister Elsa, she can give us what she needs. I kind of like that the sister mystery has been drawn out a little bit more in this version.
Okay, cool.
I don't know, it's probably happened because you've, you know, added some other stuff to it, too. More relationships, things between the daughter and father and things like that.
Yeah, definitely there's something there with that.
Bottom of 124, he says, hey, Monty's like, can we get these to go? I want to get to Edgewater. And he says, let's go grab the car. I just made the comment that I don't think he said what time it was in the morning.
I could sneak that in somewhere.
Yeah, I'm gonna be a piece of cake. And at the very bottom of the page, they end up at the Edgewater Hotel. That first line of the description, I think I get what you're going for, but the way it's written, I think you need to tweak it a little bit.
Okay.
Inside the hotel lobby, everything has a place and things are in their place. I think, yeah, it seems to be reworded. Reworded.
Yeah, okay. Cool.
125. I guess the sentence starts on 124. We pass rugs that are fully furnished islands on a sterile sea. Now that I'm reading that again, I don't like that fully furnished, but I'm going to let that go this draft. On a sterile sea of white tile that glows under the bright chandeliers. It made it sound like the tile was actually glowing, whereas this shortens up a little bit, and we know that it's white, and that just is bright under the chandeliers, you know, glows under the chandeliers.
Yeah, being a resort, was kind of I had to use some creative license, because I couldn't find any interior pictures of this place, and it's gone. It's gone now. It's been gone for a long time. And it was a resort. It was a beach resort. So I was like, I'm thinking it was probably pretty fancy.
Yeah. Interesting that there were not even any black and white pictures or anything somewhere.
Yeah. I can find exterior ones, but I can't find any interior ones, which has just been a nightmare.
I like how everything from the biggest hotels to the smallest diners are actually places that really existed.
Yeah. I wanted to kind of really try to rock that in this and try to make them actually exist. You know, creative license needed if needed. But,
sure.
But yeah.
Why does Richter's gallery come to mind when he walks into this like clean hotel.
Oh, just the sterile, kind of the sterile feel of it.
I might want that expanded.
Okay.
And then the next paragraph, still on 125, the concierge, I can't tell what the original sentence was. Anyway, the concierge stares at Monty. Oh, you had the concierge stares in Monty's direction. And I think just if he's staring at Monty, we already kind of like crossed out the direction stuff. And then instead of what seems to be disdain, I thought it'd read better if it was disdain, because I think Toom's just going to call it the way he sees it. And that makes the sentence a little shorter and easier to read. I'm halfway down, 125 still. James says, we already talked with the police on this matter, detectives. Which got me to thinking of, number one, if Toom was the lead detective, why hadn't he talked to the hotel peeps already about a dead girl on their beach?
I was asking myself that when I read your suggestion, and I was like, oh, yeah. I didn't think about it. I didn't think about it back then, but I mean, I could always change it there, or I could change it up here. We'll see how that rolls.
Yeah. So what they'll do is they'll have cops canvassing the area, they call it, looking for witnesses. So maybe the cops asked around and reported back to him they didn't find any witnesses.
Okay. Well, if you didn't find anything, I'm not going to bother to read the report.
Yeah, that was just my thought. I think, and I can't believe I've never thought about that before. Like, why wasn't Toom in that hotel asking people shit? Oh, maybe it's because the cops were supposed to ask people. Flatfoot cop.
Yeah.
Just the next line, it says Monty leaning back on the counter. I kind of picture him leaning forward on the counter, so I wasn't sure of his motion there.
Oh, I gotcha. No, I was just like thinking back, you know, leaning back on his elbows on the counter, but I was trying to not be wordy about it. But yeah, I see where that confusion could come in.
Yeah, because then his back would be to the guy.
Yeah, yeah, that wouldn't make much sense.
Oh, and then the guy said he looked at the registry on page 126, the top, and said Herr Schmidt had the room. And I was just kind of like, is that how Herr Schmidt wrote it? Because I don't picture young James saying Herr. What does Herr mean anyway?
Yeah, it's Sir. It translates to Sir. It's actually a name that was associated to, I think, Murphy Ranch, some things with Murphy Ranch. And I was kind of toying with the notion of using it as like an alias.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I could have said like, you know, John Smith, but that wouldn't be interesting.
All right. I'm not going to bother with a wrap up this time.
All right. Fair enough. I don't blame you. All right. So I'm just going to go straight into D2, go Silver Creek. I mean, no foreplay, just going straight into it. Last we left off on page 127 was Joshua sitting down with Pitt in his place of ill repute. They're gonna share a couple drinks and shoot the shit. And I actually really liked this scene between Joshua and Pitt talking about happenings and the painting. I really liked the painting. Was the painting in the last draft? Because I don't remember it.
It was not.
Okay. Yeah, I really liked the addition of the painting and talk, and it made a good prompt for bringing up. Have you seen any real horses? Just the line of questioning that comes from Joshua, especially when he asks about the Dark Rider. I really liked this whole scene. It kind of gave Joshua kind of that that inspector almost playing the role of the sheriff in his own right, asking questions and getting information. And I liked how this scene came down. And I liked the essence of the saloon, the inside of the saloon. The place felt full without a whole lot of mentioning of the patrons. I also liked the mentioning of, the painting was a copy of one from Chicago Museum of History. The original was recovered 300 years ago from the ruins of an elven castle in Bavaria.
Yes, Bavaria.
Yeah, Joshua had seen an artist's recreation of the ancient tree paleontologists believed housed the painting. It was such a thing of immensity, it was difficult to take seriously. What I'm wondering is if this is like a real world ruin of the castle in the tree that we've seen in Avis's visions, or if there's some connection between the two. I'll just call them dimensions. Now, this my great grandfather said he saw one once. The gunman said it was his favorite story. Said he saw it on a Florida expedition. Said it was the most beautiful thing he ever saw. And then I was just going to say I agreed with your parenthetical of write something cooler later. Because I was actually going to comment, like, you should have something cooler here. But then I saw the parenthetical and I was like, oh, okay. And the story itself, like, the next several days after seeing men from the expedition began disappearing. At first, they thought it may be wild animals and they endeavored to never be alone. This kind of made me think of the mystery of Roanoke. I mean, I know it's a different state. It's Virginia for Roanoke, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it made me think of, like, the disappearances at Roanoke kind of thing. I thought it was cool. Page 129, going on to page 130. This is when we get the bells that signaled the next shift. So this is right around the time of the Industrial Revolution, when we started living our lives according to steam whistles, which is great. I liked the technological marker for the time frame as far as century, decade, years wise. Joshua amused himself with the thought that either could be considered a game of chance. Some of them would get their baths here, soaked and washed by the woman of their choice. Others would go right to business and leave their woman covered in the chalky dust that marked their brief transaction. I liked this observation and the sentiment that Joshua brings to this this kind of changing of his surroundings. And again, makes Pitt's place of business feel occupied without, like, explicitly, like, describing people coming in or people that are there.
Cool.
Is Joshua an introvert? Because he has introvert tendencies here. The sudden discomfort settled over the gunman. The crowd seemed unreasonably confining and loud. He finished his second round and stood. Yeah, just kind of made me think of maybe kind of chuckle a little bit, because I was like, ah, Joshua is an introvert.
He spends a lot of time alone, you know, open spaces, going from town to town.
That is true.
Crowded places are a good place to get a shiv.
That's a good point. Yeah. Okay. And I liked the question about the Dark Rider, and then Pitt, you know, asking him, are you getting superstitious? I mean, because, well, we've already been introduced to Fido, and just that superstition question, you know, it works. I like it. I mean, especially in the world they live in. I mean, definitely there's some things to be superstitious about. And I loved this. Joshua shook his head. Not really. Maybe wearing a robe. Just got out of the shower.
Yeah.
I liked this. Now, Nancy wasn't in the last draft, was she? Or was she, like, an honorable mention, I think, when Teague was injured?
Oh, Nancy?
Was she the hooer that was in the room upstairs when they were trying to patch up?
No.
No, that was somebody
The different. Only mention Nancy gets is in the very end when Pitt leaves and he says, Nancy will take care of stuff while I'm...
Okay. I thought I remembered seeing the name somewhere before, and I couldn't place it. That's why I was asking about that, because I was like, "Well, was that her?"
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't come up with her until that last end of the first draft, and I kind of picture her as being Pitt's, like, the from the movie Tombstone, Doc's girlfriend. I picture that's Pitt's lady friend.
Ah, okay. Okay, I follow. I gotcha. So she's like the saloon hostess.
Yeah, she's the madam.
But in this case, madam. Yes, she's the madam also. She has to keep her pimp hand strong, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Pimping ain't easy.
I'm going to... Pimping ain't easy. Neither is madaming. This is a good line on 131. It's Pitt talking about Joshua, and he's all... He's thick enough, Pitt said as he rubbed a scar along his jawline, as if rubbing a magic talisman that could conjure ghosts of the past. I really liked that line. The statement actually could have like more than one meaning, but I kind of took it as like Joshua's thick-headed. But I mean, thick could go so many different ways.
No, that was him remembering that scar is from Joshua punching him in the face.
Yeah, yeah, I got that part of it. I was just thinking about the thick part, like how he meant that Joshua was thick enough, like thick skin.
Yeah, I'm trying to find that 131.
Yeah, bottom of 131, section 23.
I have it could have been less pleasant. Nancy poured whiskey into Joshua's abandoned glass. He's got the most handsome scowl I've ever seen. Pitt brought his full attention to the woman. You're a grown woman, Nancy. You can do as you please, but Joshua Stone may be best left alone.
Yes. Then the next line, so that's Joshua Stone. I thought he would be, I don't know, thicker. He's thick enough, Pitt said. Yeah.
That's on 132 for me.
Oh, weird. Okay. Yeah, it's on 131 for me.
Oh, no, I mean, I think she thought he would be bigger because he's not a big person.
Oh, okay. Okay. Alrighty, fair enough. Yeah, it was just thick. I was like trying to. There was like so many places my mind went with thick.
I didn't want to say bigger. I was looking for another word. That word might not be a good.
Yeah, maybe experiment with it a little bit. Let's see. 132. I like that Pitt, along with Nancy, have become like information brokers of sorts, or even blackmailers, in the way that that this is said. And I'm, yeah, no obstacle he could have removed or attack redirected before it began by just a hint of public revelation of sensitive information. And this has to do with, you know, rooms have ears. The girls are taken in more than their gents, you know. Yeah, I thought that was an interesting dynamic between these two, and also the establishment in and of itself that definitely Pitt is more than the sum of his parts kind of thing.
You're referring to him asking Nancy if the girls had heard anything about ghosts and shit.
Yes. Yes. But also that, you know, Pitt can kind of get what he wants from knowing things about people, especially, you know, here it is. Men in general like to talk, especially when they've been drinking and a woman places her sympathetic ear near his lips. So it's like, yeah. So it's like the girls are like their information gatherers, and then they become like information brokers, in that they use informations as a means to an end of, yeah. So it just makes Pitt definitely a much more powerful person in the Silvertip kind of business council. Because he knows stuff. He knows where all the bodies are buried.
Yeah.
Potentially. So, yeah. Yeah, I thought that was a cool character dynamic to put into just this also place of business, but also this relationship. So that, yeah, it was cool.
Thanks.
You are welcome, sir. I've totally left out the little edits, but, I mean, I can put them in if you want. But mostly it was just kind of word replacements or word ads or deleting a word for extraneous purposes. 133. One question I had here was, see, Pitt thought Joshua might not even be aware of the gunfighter's own trepidation. In this reference to Joshua, is the gunfighter's a reference to Joshua? If so, I think his might work better than gunfighter, because Joshua and gunfighter in the sentence made me think of two different people.
Okay.
In the way it's worded.
Okay.
I liked the Bow Weevil simile. That was cool. I had a suggestion, and, you know, take it or leave it, but describing the painting that's behind Pitt's desk.
Yeah.
I almost like thought about like what if it is the ruins of the tree castle that is mentioned along with the archaeologists earlier. That is if it's the same thing. Because I think it was like painted by his mother or sister.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I liked the sentiment about it too, where there were days Pitt Grimfist wanted to burn it.
I thought about having that connection that you're talking about right there with this painting to the other painting.
Uh-huh.
But I think that threw out the timeline because the elves have been gone for like 1,000 years.
Fair enough. Well, I'll be looking forward to end up seeing what you do with that. So what that painting ends up being. It'll be interesting, and especially like what it is and what makes Pitt want to burn it. I like that Fido comes back in, and we get to see a Fido Pit moment. And I thought it was interesting that Pit kind of has a chip on his shoulder with Fido. At least that's kind of what I got from the exchange of dialogue and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I thought it was funny how he comes in as a cloaked figure. Cause it's kind of like Pit. He's kind of getting himself worked up over some of this, you know, superstition of his own. It is kind of what I gathered. And that kind of makes me kind of like want to know more about, like, you know, his background as it like connects to him being an orc, like that culture of how like his superstition would affect him differently than, say, like Joshua's superstition, or if Joshua's superstitious at all. You know, I thought it was interesting. And I'm always down for some Fido time. Fido's great. And one thing I like about Fido popping up here is, you know, people are getting around and tensions are certainly ramping up. We still have some rising tensions that are, you know, going to come to a head eventually, but we still have pieces moving and, you know, kind of feeling things out. A little further down, page 134, Fido reached into his pouch and set a crumpled piece of paper on it. Now, did he set the piece of paper on the pouch or the desk? Or did he put his pouch on the desk and then put his thing on the pouch?
The desk.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool. I wasn't sure. I was confused and it took me out. And then I'm wondering what you're going to end up naming the dagger, because there's no name for it yet, according to the parenthetical. So I'm curious as to what you'll come up with for that. We'll see. 135. Didn't really have much to say on 135. I had a couple, like a little edit here and there. Okay, we get kind of a on 135. We get more interaction between Fido and Pit. And Pit says, "I still don't know what you want." And Fido answers in a question of what your blood demands. And that gets an interesting reaction from him, because it says, get out, or I will kill you." So Fido ends up like being like sent away, and he turns away and he waddles out. What I really want to know is like what your blood demands, like that connection between like Pit getting so bent out of shape. And for me, that was the most important thing in this scene. Cause after Fido leaves, I believe that there's a knock on the wall and Nancy comes in. And there was a line I liked on this page as well, 135. It's like halfway down. Pit's olive skin deepened and his lips pulled back like a starving wolf guarding its kill. And that's when he tells Fido to get out, or I will kill you.
Yeah, Pit is like, I think I hinted at it earlier. Pit is like Lucy Liu's character in Kill Bill. He doesn't want a certain half of his ancestry mentioned, or he'll fuck you up.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So this is something new, I think, and it's on the top of 136. Nancy asks them, "Are you all right, Nikolai?" So Pitt's real name is Nikolai?
Yeah.
Interesting. Was it Nikolai in the last draft at all? I mean, or is that something totally new?
Pitt was his nickname. I knew I wanted him to have a regular name. I didn't know what last draft.
Cool. Actually, I think Nikolai works. Nikolai Grimfist. It flows off the tongue nice. I like it. And then he lies to Nancy when she asks him who he was talking to. And he says, "Nobody, darling. Nobody." Still page 136. We get Joshua going back to check on Chalk. And Chalk's disappeared from the...
telegraph office?
Telegraph office. Thank you. So he's disappeared from the telegraph office. And he has no clue where Chalk's gone. So he goes into the hotel. I thought the name of the hotel was mentioned here, but
It is Ruby Rose.
Ruby Rose, that's it. Yeah, right at the top. Okay. He goes into the Ruby Rose, and Caroline Brody's there standing by a piano. And I think there's a word missing in this highlighted section.
Yeah, I'll work on it.
Yeah, she joins him at the table, and she says, "I came alone." This was good. "They let you wander around alone," Joshua said as his eyes came back to Caroline's. There was a hypnotic effect produced by those violet, and I think that's supposed to be eyes instead of arms. Yeah, the violet eyes are definitely definitely cool. I like the, I like that the idea of violet eyes. I mean, yeah. Doubt for her safety was replaced by surety. Anyone those eyes fell on would stand between her and danger without hesitation. I don't know. The wording took me out. I mean, I get what it's saying, but the wording took me out. I don't know. So she makes her case that she's capable. Then she asks him about the investigation. And I liked his answer that there are a lot of strange things in this world.
What is that, 138?
I found another The Cranston Brody, so I had to ask that The. But I did like the projections that Caroline and Joshua kind of talk about with in relations between the Brodies and the Nesters, and like what could possibly like give Cranston the excuse he would need to crush the Nesters if they tried something foolish. Let's see, section 25. Caroline returns to the piano, and I believe that Joshua returns to his room, or goes up to his room, and he's worried about Chalk, and he still hasn't heard from him. And then he's feeling worried about Chalk because Silvertip is a wretched hive for scum and villainy. So, yeah, so his concern for Chalk is, yeah, it's a little bit deeper than normal. 139, takes his boots off. And he gets a knock on the door, and it's Caroline Brody in her yellow dress and her white ribbons. She wore a white ribbon, and they have a back and forth about him letting her in and her honor being sullied. And yeah, this scene reminds me a lot of from the last draft. They kind of get their human mating ritual on as far as their dialogue and little undressing of each other. And
you on page 140?
I'm on page 140 now, yeah. And let's see, 140, I had a little edit, not far from the top. And then after that, there's the line, humans have odd customs. To be restricted in such a fashion in the name of imagined propriety. And I'm still liking this line coming from her. And it's kind of a tell of sorts. I mean, you wouldn't know it, but I know things that other people don't know. So, but I'm going to keep those to myself for, you know, posterity or whatever. And then Chalk does show up, and I still like this wordplay between him and Chalk, where he's talking to Chalk and Caroline thinks he's talking to her. And he's like, yeah, you should have come earlier. And she's like, well, I couldn't. And then Chalk's like telling him, you got to come down now. You know, I gotta show you this stuff. And it ends with her, you know, see, you should have been here earlier, Joshua said. I couldn't be. Caroline walked her fingers up the gunman's chest and finished unbuttoning his shirt. She looked upward into his gray eyes. Forgive me? Joshua returned her gaze and the world dissolved into violet eyes. I could be persuaded. Yeah, I still like that scene between them when Chalk shows up and just the dialogue. It's a fun scene, and that's what I got, man.
All right, cool.
Do you have any questions or anything?
I don't think I do.
Okay, fair enough.
Since we're not actually sure how you're going, let's just wrap this up.
Okay.
Thanks for tuning in. Check out patreon.com/Pacific Novel Project if you want to see what else we got going on. Find us on Google Play. Write a review. Give us a like.
Yes, if you must drag us through the mud, do so in a creative fashion.
We respect creativity.